Hi, welcome to episode 6 of the Woke-ish podcast. This is Ebony.
And this is Zelma.
And this week, we have so many interesting things to talk about. I mean, the news has been all over the place. There's tons of trending topics, and so we're going to probably hit on all of them. But to get started, we will start with our shout-out segment.
Yes, and so our first shout-out is because March is actually Women's History Month. And so we just wanted to shout out all the women who have contributed to history and also all the women in our lives. I had totally forgot that March was Women's History Month, but just shout out to all the women in your life and definitely to all the women both who have been overlooked or forgotten in history or for the ones who that we are just learning about. Our next shout out goes to Nathan Alexander, who is a Morehouse College professor who went viral for holding his student's baby during class so he could take better notes. Apparently, the student was unable to find a babysitter but didn't want to miss his class, so the professor held the baby so that the student could take notes. And so I think this is a shout-out not only because the professor allowed, quote-unquote, the student to have the baby in the class, mm-hmm. but he was actually active in helping the parent take better notes. And I think just being a parent who is still in school, I find that even with people that I have good relationships with, like professors or things, thinking about bringing my baby to a meeting makes me really scared. Like, oh, what if they tell me like to take him outside, or what if they get mad at me, or what if they think this is unprofessional? But just like sometimes things happen and you can't, you know, you just have to bring them. Like tomorrow I'm bringing my baby to another meeting. And that's, you know, it's because even though I'm fortunate enough to be able to afford daycare, but a lot of people won't work unless there's a minimum number of hours that they are babysitting. And so because this meeting is only an hour long, I find it like a waste to pay someone to take care of him for 3 hours just so that I could have a 1 hour meeting. And then I know some people could be like, well, take that time to do something else, but it's like I'm breastfeeding, and so I have to, my body has to feed him a certain number of times or else I'm very uncomfortable. And so I actually like physically have to be near the baby if I have to be at somewhere for more than 2 hours at a time, and that includes driving and all that stuff. So definitely shout out to Nathan Alexander. I think there should be more people, not only professors, but people in the workplace that understand that for a society that values family so much, that there should be like accommodations for people to actually be able to parent and have those families.
Okay. And our third shout out goes to SNL's Leslie Jones and Kenan Thompson for their parody of the Gayle King and R. Kelly interview. It was hilarious.
Yeah.
Like, I was in tears.
Yeah.
And it was super spot on. Yes, if you haven't seen his interview, you need to watch it.
Yeah. And then the parody.
Yeah. Because, like, the interview itself is hilarious.
Yeah.
Like, it's, I mean, some of the stuff he was saying is like, it's like, oh, he's crazy. Like, it just all of a sudden occurs to you that he's not all the way there. And then the parody on top of that, I think that the original interview makes you look at him like, oh, he's out of his mind.
Yeah.
But then the parody makes you look at yourself in society as like, how is this man still not in prison?
Yeah.
They really point out kind of the obvious, and they just, it's like one of the, at one point, Kenan is like, you know, why would you think I would do this when I've done it before and have been doing the same thing for 30 years? And then he goes through some of R. Kelly's song titles, and he's like, all the evidence is right there, but why would you think I'm guilty? And I'm like, oh my God, this is so true. How can we not put two and two together? Yeah, so shout out to them. It was awesome. And then shout out to the organizers of the Speak Truth Summit. Today is their mini summit in Michigan called Speak and Share, where they will engage in a conversation on what self-advocacy in the workplace for women of color looks like, challenges and successes alike. This will be the first of 3 speak and share sessions that will lead up to their annual Speak Truth Summit on October 5th. If you're listening and are interested in attending, visit speaktruthsummit.com. Yeah, and shout out to them. They're doing amazing work. They send us emails every once in a while to let us know about their events. They just so happen to be kind of far away.
Yeah.
But I want to do better to try to follow up and maybe attend this summit in October. I think that would be awesome.
Yeah.
Okay, that wraps up our shout out segment. And now for our In the Know segment. Extra, extra, read all about it. Okay, so now for our In the Know segment.
Yes. And so our first In the Know topic is based on this article that I came across. And so this is stuff that we kind of learn about in our sociology classes here in our graduate program. But I think it also is helpful to break it down for a lot of people who I think sometimes both white and people of color like don't understand or don't really get why a lot of people stress the importance of owning a house. I think some people are just kind of like, I'm fine living in an apartment, I'm fine not owning a house. Like, everyone's preference is different. Mm-hmm. And so this article kind of breaks down why it's important. And so what this article focused on was a decrease in Black home ownership. And so the Washington Post recently covered a story, it was in February, about how over the past decade, the real estate fortunes for African Americans have hit a pitfall. And this is despite a strengthening economy, which includes record low unemployment and higher wages for Black workers. And if you can recall, this is what Trump always talks about, how, you know, unemployment rates for African American has been the lowest that it's ever been.
All because of him.
All because of him. And so, unfortunately, though, although unemployment has gone down and higher wages and wages have increased for Black workers, home ownership levels for this group has dropped almost every year since 2004. So African Americans are actually owning less homes every year. Fell to 43% in 2017, virtually erasing all the gains made since the passage of the Fair Housing Act in 1968, which outlawed housing discrimination. So now we are actually doing, it's like we undid the progress that had been done during the Civil Rights Movement. And so researchers at the Urban Institute found large disparities, so large differences, between the home ownership rates of Black families and white families in all 100 of the cities with the largest Black population, pushing the housing gap between the two groups to its highest in more than 50 years. So not only is it alarming that Black ownership is decreasing, but the gap between Black ownership and white ownership is increasing. Mm-hmm. And so the reason for this downturn in Black home ownership is there's lots of them. And so this article went through a couple. So one of them includes a lack of affordable housing in some areas and chronically low inventory in others. So kind of saying that the houses available to African American homeowners is lower. Rising student debt is also an issue too, as more financially strapped buyers struggle to save for a down payment. So one of the things is that, and there's research that shows that Black owners, or that Black homeowners, when they go to real estate agents, they're only shown houses in certain neighborhoods because there's self-segregation. So like white people want to live with white people. And so real estate agents are, when they show certain people houses, they show houses where they think that they would not only afford these houses, but also where they think that it is kind of racial bias. But the thing that I thought was new that research hasn't pointed to is how the student debt is keeping Black ownership from rising. And so even though people are educated and getting higher rates of college degrees, because of their debt, they're not able to do the next step, which is like, you know, the American dream is like, you go to college, you buy a house, you get married, and you have kids. Well, if you go to college and you have to take loans to go to college, you can't, for many of us, you can't do the next step, which is to buy a house.
So I mean, because one reason that I'm thinking that, I mean, I think it's the pursuit of higher education, right? So our generation has more Black college students than any prior generation.
Yeah.
And I think that we're also, a lot of these cities that they're referring to are transplant cities. And so you have a lot of people that are moving for the job and they don't plan to stay where they are long term, which is why I think a lot of times these surveys need to be coupled with, I mean, granted, it's, you know, it's difficult, but coupled with qualitative interviews, right? Because I think that you would find that a lot of young Black professionals are living in cities that they are not from, like cities that they weren't raised in, so where their families are not located, but then also cities that they don't plan to stay in long term. So if I only plan to stay in this city while I build my career for 5 to 10 years, then I may not buy a house because I plan to move back to wherever I'm from. You know, and like, I mean, I'm thinking about that because my partner and I are talking about buying houses now, right? But we don't know where we're gonna live. Like, I'm from California, he's from New Jersey, but we'll likely be moving when I finish school. And so if we buy a house in Texas, you know, it would either be like an investment property or we would have to come back to Texas. You know, and I think that that's the case for a lot of my friends too, who want to buy a house, but you know, feel like that would force them to settle in a place that they don't know that they would necessarily want to live.
I think that's true. And you know, my partner is white, and he bought a house using money that he got from a trust fund. And
oh, really? I didn't know that.
Yeah, and he said that if he never came back to the city where he bought the house, it was fine because this is an investment.
Yeah.
And I don't think, like, I would never be able to view something like that. Like, it never in my mind would I think, like, oh, let me just buy a $200,000 house.
Yeah.
And it's okay. I can, you know, lose. I don't need that money right now.
Yeah.
And I'll just wait it out until I get a return
on it.
Equity
in the property. Yeah.
Yeah, where he can think in those terms and I can't. And so I think that that also adds to, like, you know, the people that we know who can't make decisions. Okay, well, I live here for 5 years. Let me make this investment. It's like we have to think twice about where we put our money because we don't have as much disposable income or wealth, which we'll talk about later, as other groups who have had it transmitted and passed down in their families.
Yeah, because ultimately you have to have the money for a down payment.
Yeah.
And so I mean, it's like, for the investment, your kids will benefit,
you know,
in the long run, but it's like you at the time will not. It's like that your equity is in that property and that it's, you know, it's not liquid cash.
And then, as we would all guess, discrimination also plays a large role in this gap. So Lisa Rice, who's the president and chief executive of the National Fair Housing Alliance, NFHA, said that a study by the group found that real estate discrimination was pervasive in at least a dozen major metropolitan areas. Mm-hmm. In some cases, even when Black applicants had higher credit scores, they were often offered worse financing terms than less qualified white people. So it's hard to argue that bias isn't a factor. Mm-hmm. So even when you have Black people or trying to buy homes, they're paying more, they're getting worse deals on the loans, or they might be getting properties that aren't going to be valued as much as white homeowners. And you know, this says that even when they have higher credit scores, and people may ask, well, how do you even test this? How do you even see this? And so one of the interesting types of tests are like audit studies, where people, you know, go out and actually do like quote unquote real life experiments, where you'll have Black applicants and white applicants both go to the same people and apply, or you you know, look at the, like here they're looking at credit scores, and so they see two people who are the same age, who are both married, who live in the same city and who have similar credit scores. So you look at, if everything else is the same and the only thing that's different is the race, then that is probably what's driving the difference. And so these are the types of studies, and as Ebony mentioned, it's really difficult to just with numbers or surveys pinpoint to, well, this is the main reason why we see this difference. But I think adding everything together, in the fact that it's just every year that Black home ownership decreases, it's a problem. And we're going to talk about that, continue this conversation in our What's Being Slept On, because home ownership is a key factor in wealth. And so wealth is really important, not just for owning homes, but it influences so much of your life. And we're going to get into that in our What's Being Slept On. But I just wanted to bring up this Black home ownership article as a context to our bigger conversation about inequality, and just saying that, like, owning property has always been very important in the United States. It was one of the criteria to be able to vote in the Constitution. You had to own property. It was one of the ways that they kept former slaves from being able to vote. It was one of the ways that they kept women from being able to vote. Home ownership is also how you fund schools. And so there's a lot that's tied to home ownership. It also dictates where you live, what neighborhoods you live in, who you're surrounded by. And so the fact that there's a disparity or a large difference where black home ownership is kind of getting a disadvantage is a problem. So we'll definitely circle back to this in our discussion, but I just wanted to highlight this because when you hear things like Trump saying, oh, black unemployment is at the lowest, wages are at the highest, there's no more racism, racism is dead, you have to look at the bigger picture of, oh, well, once I learn that, yes, but home ownership is lower every year. It's even lower than when we made discrimination illegal, then that's says to me that there's something wrong. And so I think that it also kind of pushes us to think more deeply and have these different conversations when people try to come at you with, you know, numbers that say, oh, well, racism is gone because we're improving in one area. You have to say, okay, we're improving in one area. Are we doing worse in another area? And how is that compared to this other racial group? So if you know, we're doing really bad. If this one group is doing better, is it still a lot worse or lower than this other group? Because if it is, then that's still a problem.
Okay. And now to our second in the know topic. So there is a new Democratic candidate entering the 2020 presidential race every month, maybe even every week, because there's so many at this point. So we have former Representative Beto O'Rourke, former Governor John Hickenlooper, Governor Jay Inslee, Senator Bernie Sanders, Senator Amy Klobuchar, I butchered that, Senator Elizabeth Warren, Senator Cory Booker, Senator Kamala Harris, ex-San Antonio Mayor Julian Castro, Representative Tulsi Gabbard, former Representative John Delaney, author Marianne Williamson, and former tech executive Andrew Yang. So you probably recognize a lot of those names. And actually, I wanted to talk about the last two names, author Marianne Williamson and former tech executive Andrew Yang, because I feel like they're kind of running on the most controversial platforms as of now. So Marianne Williamson wants to give black people, well, the descendants of slaves, reparations. And Andrew Yang wants to give all Americans between the ages of 18 and 64 $1,000 a month. I guess, I don't know, I mean, I guess for the term of his presidency, or I don't know how long that would last, because somebody definitely would, if that happened, someone would come along and, you know, undo that. But I think that these, you know, these two platforms are, you know, they're controversial, and because they're controversial, they're super, like, hot topics. It's like, oh my God, like, you know, could this actually happen? Now, one of my critiques is that there are way too many people in the race, right? And that ultimately, what does that do? That messes up the vote. And so we were talking about like there are a lot of differences between what things should be and what things are. So it should be that all candidates can run on a platform, and that the platform be that it be unbiased, right? So that we not look at them based on their race or based on their gender, but based solely on content of their character, right? And so that is the way that it should be. But the way that it is that we have all of these people running against an incumbent who has a pretty strong base, and a pretty strong racist and sexist base, and they are not. If we can look at the 2016 election as evidence, you know, we can see that they are not going to be too happy about a woman candidate. I feel like they aren't going to take too kindly to a candidate of color because of how much resentment they still have toward Barack Obama. So as of Monday morning, Yang had exceeded 65,000 donors, thus clearing a threshold the Democratic National Committee has set for eligibility in the first two debates. So he will be a part of the first two debates, and I guess we'll continue to see. I'm not sure if that is the case for all the other Democratic candidates yet, but so he definitely has some supporters, and I think that they, you know, they all do have a decent, they do also have a decent amount of support, but ultimately what counts is that they need to beat Trump, and I think that they're splitting the vote a little bit too finely.
Yeah.
So we'll see. I mean, I still do love Bernie, but I feel like one of the big reasons that, you know, they didn't, that he wasn't nominated before is because he was too old. Well, I mean, and then there was a bunch of corruption, but also because he was too old, right?
Yeah.
And so now it's like...
too liberal.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And so, with actually, some of the things that they were saying about Bernie, about him being a socialist and all that stuff, are essentially some of the same things that they're saying about this Andrew Yang guy, too.
Yeah. Now, my partner was saying, we have very difficult conversations, how he is... he thinks he's Republican.
He thinks Bernie's Republican.
No, that he himself is Republican. And that if Bernie were to be the Democratic, that he leans more Republican than Democrat, because he's saying that the Democratic Party has become too liberal for him. And if Bernie was going to be the Democratic nominee, then he'd have to vote third party. Like, he wouldn't vote for Trump, but he wouldn't vote for... And I'm like, I could see a lot of people thinking like him and being like, this person is too liberal for me, and this person is too conservative for me, so the only choice I have is either not vote or vote for this third party.
Yeah, which, I mean, I so the reason that I don't like that logic is because the third party is not going to win.
Yeah, that's what I tell him.
It literally is a wasted vote.
That's what I told him.
Like, yeah, we have these extra parties, but it's a two-party system. Like, we've only ever had Democratic or Republican presidents. Well, not only ever. I think that there were one or two others, but I can't recall. It was like
someone was like the Whig party.
Long before I existed. Yeah. Yeah, and so it's like you might as well kind of vote for one of these peeps.
Yeah, no, but I'm with you, but I also can see a lot of people.
Yeah, no, people are gonna do that.
Well, I don't give a shit.
Yeah, people are definitely gonna do
that. This is my protest vote.
Yeah. Okay. Well, yeah, we'll keep you updated. I'm looking forward to watching all the debates and everything, and seeing how everything plays out. Because I don't really have a firm, like, aside from being like, oh, you know, you're running on this platform, that's not going to work. Like, I mean, would it be nice for Black people to get reparations? I mean, I don't know, monetary reparations kind of just, I don't think that would be effective. I feel like if nothing else, there should be like some kind of tuition waiver or something like that. Mm. I don't think that they should just start giving Black people $5,000 checks.
No, no, no.
Oh, maybe a house. That would be cool.
I think we should get houses.
But not checks. I feel like checks, like, because people, they will blow it.
Yeah.
They will blow it. No. Like, you know, so no. I think that they need to do something that's going to have long-lasting benefits.
No, I agree.
But, yeah, I don't know about that.
So our next story is about how there were no charges in the police shooting of Stephon Clark. And so for those of you, because there have been, unfortunately, so many police shootings, to recap, two Sacramento police officers who shot and killed an unarmed Black man in his grandmother's backyard last year are not going to face criminal prosecution. The Sacramento County District Attorney announced on last week, stirring fresh outrage in a city ruled by protesting over the killing. So after the DA announced this, there's a lot of protests in Sacramento. Mm-hmm. So this was a guy who was in a backyard and the police shot him and then claimed that he was threatening, and then a bunch, of course, like, went into a bunch of reasons why they think that he should have been shot. So Ms. Schubert, the district attorney, said the officers had probable cause to stop and detain Mr. Clark. She added that the police officers are legally justified in using deadly force, quote unquote, if the officer honestly and reasonably believes he is in danger of death or injury, which is what they always say.
And how can you even assess that?
I know. So they're saying, she's saying, we must recognize that they are often forced to make split-second decisions. We must also recognize that they are under tense, uncertain, and rapidly evolving circumstances. Mm-hmm. During a news conference on Saturday, however, Mr. Clark's mother, Sequeet Clark, said, quote unquote, "We're outraged that the district attorney decided not to prosecute the officers." She blasted the district attorney also for delving into details she said were irrelevant to the officer's conduct, which I totally agree, including personal text messages and a toxicology report showing that Mr. Clark had alcohol, codeine, marijuana, cocaine, and Xanax in his system.
All while he was in his grandparents' backyard.
Yeah, and I think, and the police were... Never did they say, we believe that he is inebriated, we believe that he's under the influence, we believe that he is on drugs. It's just kind of like a quote-unquote godsend for them to be like, oh, thank God he was on drugs. Yeah. We can totally justify this killing by saying, he was on drugs, so we I was in fear, although that's like
bullshit. Well, you're at my house.
Yeah, because he was in his grandmother's backyard. So another situation where you have no accountability for the death of an unarmed black man, and like we said, I think that one of the tactics that the police uses is to kind of portray the victim as a criminal after he has died, so that they can justify the murder as saying, well, this is, you know, the police were justified in their deadly force because this person was a criminal anyway, or was engaging in criminal acts, even though when it comes down to it, he was unarmed and he was in his grandmother's backyard.
Yeah, and it's like somehow, I don't know. We act like it really irritates me when there are these, like, the ethics police come out. Ethics police, and I'm saying that I didn't mean for the pun was not intended. When all these people sit on their high horses and they're like, well, yeah, you know, they shouldn't have been on drugs, or they shouldn't have been doing X, Y, and Z. He was minding his business. There are plenty of people that are on drugs. What happened to, oh, drug abuse is a disease, and all of these things that sound good when they're being used to justify drug abuse for white folks, but then when it comes to people of color, suddenly drug use makes them criminal, not having some kind of illness. Yeah. You know, and I mean, I'm so, that's, ugh, God. I actually saw someone talking about this yesterday, and they were saying, you know, that this is not, that, you know, this is, Stephon Clark should not be the focus of, you know, Black Lives Matter. I guess the police asked him to do something that he didn't do, like maybe put his hands up or get on the ground or something like that. And so they were claiming that he resisted arrest. Mm-hmm. But it's like, I am surprised to see you. I'm in my grandparents' backyard. Yeah. You are the one that doesn't belong. And so, I mean, I'm sure he, like, because he wasn't doing anything illegal, it probably didn't occur to him that, oh, I could potentially be under arrest. Yeah. If you're just minding your business, why would it make sense to you for the police to be arresting you? It wouldn't. Yeah. And it's like, and the police are not just, the police have barged into folks' homes and killed plenty of innocent people, and yet that doesn't stop them from continuing to barge in people's homes with their guns raised. Like, at what point are we going to say enough is enough? Enough innocent lives have been lost at the hands of police. Yes, they have to make decisions at a split second, but they often put themselves into those positions. Like, you don't have to do what you're doing.
Yeah.
You don't. This is a choice that you're making.
So, you know, which I don't even know. It's at this point, it's kind of like a rarity when police are held accountable. But we just want, I just wanted to, and well, we wanted to take point out that even though there is this whole story of he was on drugs, that's not the point of this story. The point of this story is that he was unarmed and he was shot by police, and it wasn't until much later that the drug use became relevant.
Yeah.
And there are plenty of white people who are pointing guns at police that don't get shot, and we never ever hear about their drug use or about their toxicology reports.
Nope.
And so I think it is a tactic used for people of color to criminalize them, because it just makes, I think, people feel better about the murder of an unarmed man.
I would say it operates less so to criminalize the victim, and more so to decriminalize the police.
Mm.
Because it's like, you know, we view the police as hostile, right? And as, you know, these, like, ravaged beasts that are just, like, going around killing innocent minorities. And in a lot of cases, that is the case. And I think that because they know that narrative exists, it's like, oh, let's make this person seem like they were doing something wrong so that the cops don't look bad. Ugh. Anyways. Okay, and then also some more like fuck shit. So there's a 12-year-old rapper who's facing felony charges for allegedly selling mixtapes at a Georgia mall. So yes, you heard me correctly. He's 12, facing felony charges for allegedly selling his CDs at the mall. So on April 26th, Corey Losino Jackson, I had never heard of this little kid.
I follow him on Instagram. Really? Yeah.
So he appeared in court and after he was arrested for allegedly selling his mixtape at a mall in Georgia back in October. He's facing charges for disorderly conduct with violence, criminal trespassing, and an obstruction felony.
A felony.
At 12. Corey has posted about his run-in with the police on Instagram multiple times, explaining that he's now scared of the police. He says, "I know that I didn't do anything wrong." He added that he feels like the police treated him as if he were a robber or a murderer or something. Mm-hmm. And it's just like, it's so sad. It's like, why can't you just send the kid away with a citation or something? Like, why do you need to give a 12-year-old a felony that's going to fuck up the rest of his life?
Yeah, or a warning like you do for so many.
Yeah, it doesn't make sense. Or if you don't want him at the mall anymore, ban him from the mall. Yeah. Like, even that to me seems drastic, but come on now, like, a felony?
I follow him, and I've seen videos of the police harassing him, and I just, and then I've also seen videos where there's the adults that he's with are, like, angry, of course, with justification.
Yeah.
My 12-year-old is being treated like an adult man, and manhandled like an adult man.
Yeah, and he's, like, this tall.
Yeah,
like,
I would jump in and be like, hey, like, you don't need to speak to him, he's 12. Then I've seen the police turn on the adults, and, like, also the adults get in trouble, and then the whole narrative becomes, oh, well, if they would have just complied and cooperated with the police, then it wouldn't have gotten.
Yeah.
But it's like,
and then you wonder why the police are why these kids are afraid of you.
And at 12, to start becoming afraid of the police, like, that's traumatized. That's you being traumatized at a developmental point in your life that is very, very vital. And so he is now going to be scared of law enforcement for the rest of his life.
Yeah. And then they said that he's 12. I don't know who he was at the mall with, but that he tried to call his dad on the phone and they wouldn't refuse to talk to his dad. Like, why do you refuse to talk to the father of this child? Like, he is a child. And that's also the problem, is that the, like, little black boys are treated as and viewed in the eyes of police as adults.
Yeah.
You know, and are treated as such. And they don't get the opportunity to be kids.
Yeah. Like these next people we're going to talk about and are being slept on.
Like, they're still being treated. Okay, anyways.
Yeah.
Okay, so now we're going to move on to our What's Being Slept On segment. And we'll be back.
So I strongly suggest that you wake the fuck up.
Okay, so now for our What's Being Slept On segment. So we are going to be talking about this college admission scandal, but within the context of wealth and higher education. So, you know, this scandal has kind of been in the media for the last 2 days, so you probably have heard about it, but we're going to give you a little bit more detail and, of course, our opinions. So a total of 50 people nationwide were arrested in the largest college admission scam ever prosecuted by the Department of Justice. Those arrested include exam administrators, coaches at elite schools, and nearly three dozen parents, including actress Felicity Huffman and Lori Loughlin, who played Aunt Becky on Full House, which completely breaks my heart. I think that there are going to be some other celebrities that whose names come out soon, too.
Yeah, a bunch of
too.
Rich people.
Yeah. Yeah. Prosecutors are calling it a conspiracy nationwide in scope. William Rick Singer, the man who owned and operated Edge College and Career Network, LLC, is at the center of the collegiate scheme, and he's pleaded guilty to four charges: a racketeering conspiracy, money laundering, tax conspiracy, and obstruction of justice. Singer is facing a maximum of 65 years in prison, 3 years of supervised release, a $1.25 million fine, $400 special assessment, and his sentencing, I don't know why I can't get my words together today, his sentencing is scheduled for June 19th. So what were the different routes taken by the parents to cheat their kids into school? There were essentially two kinds of fraud that Singer was selling. One was to cheat on the SAT or ACT, and the other was to use his connections with Division I coaches and use bribes to get these parents' kids into school and fake their athletic credentials. Some parents took advantage of one. I think Ms. Huffman, for example, took advantage of one of these, which was the SAT cheating scam. Some took advantage of the other, and some took advantage of both. So Lori Loughlin's daughters got into USC on fake rowing scholarships. So they actually were not rowers. And so they were just kind of like sitting out or redshirting or whatever. Which is like completely ridiculous. And she also had somebody take her daughter's SAT test. And she got like almost a perfect score. And so with that kind of background, and you know, like we both feel very passionately about this topic because we're currently students at predominantly white institutions. Both of us attended undergrad at predominantly white institutions. And, you know, we are, when it comes to education, you know, we both come from impoverished backgrounds. We're both women of color. And so when it comes to things like this, when we have both, you know, both us and our parents have kind of sacrificed everything to get us to this point, and we see, you know, the different ways that wealth continues to benefit white people. And also in lieu of conversations about, or in addition to conversations about affirmative action and all of these things, and how, you know, some schools have quotas, and how a lot of students of color are taunted and denigrated and accused of being affirmative action recipients, and are treated as inferior, as though they don't fit and don't belong. We have made this topic the point of our, or the base of our What's Being Slept On segment. And so now Zelma's going to give a little bit of information about what wealth is, and then we're going to jump into the conversation.
Yeah. And so before I get into the discussion of wealth, I wanted to bring up one of the things that made me most mad about the cheating scandal is that, so the way that they were able to get people to take the, get someone else to take their exam for them or to change the answers was that they claimed a disability status for their kids.
I did not know that.
So they paid a psychiatrist, I think like $5,000 to write them a letter and say that they had a disability and needed extra time.
People this who have just a, way more, yeah, this just
people
gets
who
more
have
shady.
A disability take the test by themselves with a proctor. So it's just them and the proctor, and they were able to bribe that proctor to be able to either not know or like ignore that someone else was taking the test for them, or to go ahead and change the answers. And why it's so frustrating for me is that my brother has a disability status. And so it took him a couple of years, one, because the exam to be able to have a psychiatrist tell you that you write a letter of that you deserve disability status or that you are eligible for it is very expensive. Like my brother couldn't afford it. And so it took him a long
just
time.
Just the letter?
Just to be seen by a, because it's a special type of assessment. Only a certain type of psychiatrist or psychologist can give this assessment. And so my brother had to wait for a university who is trains people to do this. So it's like discounted, but the waiting list is like months and months and months. So he was able to he used that to be able to, at a like a discounted rate, get this letter that said, and my brother had a traumatic brain injury. And so he has, he can't retain information. So he can't, he can't memorize things or remember things. So he needs more time to be able to, and different ways to be able to take tests. And so when I heard that, like, they just, one, took advantage of this disability status, and two, easily just bypassed the system and paid someone to lie about this when it took so long for my brother to get this, who actually has a disability, it was just really frustrating, because I know that some people are not, now people are calling for them to revise the disability process. And it was already hard for my brother to prove that he had a disability. He had to get his records from the hospital. He had to go to the psychologist. He had to have letters from like people, like my mom, from a therapist saying he needs this, like so much. And it took a long time. He had to meet with the
director, the dean, in order to prove they had a disability status, and these people just like
bought their way in.
And so it's just really frustrating because now, because of people like this, the whole system is being under attack.
Yeah.
And this system that already took so long for people like my brother to use is now going to become even that much more difficult and probably that much more strict. And it's going to discourage a lot more people from using it. And the sad thing is you have to renew your disability status. So just because my brother had it once doesn't mean he has it again. And so he had to pay again to be able to get another therapist or psychologist to say, yep, still disabled. And so it's just really frustrating to think that now it's just going to be harder for people like my brother. Yeah. So before I moved on to talking about wealth, I just wanted to bring that up because that fits into a conversation of how rich people or people with advantages use resources that are meant to help disadvantaged people in a way that benefit them.
And then not only that, but they complain about it when it's there for those people. Yes, so it's like there are people that are in disadvantaged positions and then all you hear are these wealthy white people complain.
Yeah.
Like as if these people are getting handouts. Oh, why do they deserve it? Why do they deserve it? But then you abuse it using your money. Like,
like, why do we have to pay for disability center? My kids, you know,
have to pay for that. That money shouldn't come out of my taxes.
Yeah.
Until you want to manipulate the system in order to get your child into a university where they don't deserve to be and then cheat someone else out of that spot.
Yeah. And apparently this guy told the students, told the parents, everyone does this. Everyone does the disability thing to get more time. Even if they don't cheat, they do it as a way for their kids to get more time on the SAT.
Who is everyone?
That's what I'm saying.
Who is everyone? Because first of all, people of color walk the straight and narrow because they're afraid of getting something taken away from them, something that they deserve.
Yeah.
So you know what we would do is like, so I went to a pretty like shitty high school, right? And so what I would do is just like study my ass off. Pray to God that I do well on this test, well enough so that I can get into school.
I mean, that's what my brother
get there did. Early. Yeah. You know, and literally that is what we did. Like I vividly remember my dad waking me up at the crack of dawn, us sitting in the parking lot waiting for the test center to open.
Yeah.
Like it was like, no, you're not going to blow this.
Yeah.
You're not going to do anything that blows this opportunity. And these people have everything. Everything.
Yeah.
And not only is that not enough, but they also want to take things from us.
Yeah. Yeah. And so to start the conversation, we wanted to kind of break down what wealth is. And so wealth is your assets minus your debt. And so just like, for example, just because you may own lots of things, if you have debt, that doesn't mean make you wealthy. So for example, like a lot of people point to Trump and say he had a lot of assets. Mm-hmm. He had a lot of buildings. He had a lot of houses, a lot of cars, but he was also in a lot of debt. So he didn't have a lot of wealth at different points in his life. Or for people like for me, you know, I have a lot of debt. So anytime I remember I was applying for like a credit card. And they were like, you know, do you have any assets? And I was like, well, you know, I mean, my partner owns a home and I'm on the papers for the home in terms of the financing. And he's like, well, do you have any debt? And I was like, yeah, I have student loan debt. And he's like, okay, so we're going to put zero. And it was just kind of like my debt outweighed how much I had, like all the money that I had, everything of value, my car, like all that was swiped away by my debt. So I literally had zero wealth. And so that's why wealth is important, because it doesn't really matter. So you could be someone that makes $80,000 a year. Mm-hmm. But if you don't have a lot of assets or if you have a lot of debt, then you're not very wealthy. And so that's why home ownership is important, because home ownership is a type of asset that can lead to, that contributes to your wealth. And then also contributes to social capital, which is the people that you know and how they can help you. So for example, this guy Singer was a consultant, and so rich parents paid him to help them get into college. And so he literally, I think they even showed that they would pay someone to fill out the applications, the actual application for admissions for these kids, because these kids quote unquote didn't know how to do it.
I'm sure they didn't.
Neither did we. And so I was even surprised. I was like, wait, there are consultants that help you get into college? I didn't know that. I thought everyone else just downloaded the application and like filled it out and submitted it. And I had no idea that they were actually paying people to like help them work on their application. And it wasn't until I got into graduate school that I was able to, with my advisor, you know, she's like, send me all your applications first. I'll give you feedback and then you send it in. And I was like, oh, so other people help you. Because before this, I thought it was just me. Like, I thought my words are solely my words, unedited, are what I'm supposed to do. But it turns out, like, I have someone with a PhD and 20 plus years of experience, a former editor, redacting and editing my applications to help me make them better. And I don't know if another girl in another at a state school who's applying for the same thing has the same help. And so I think that that's how the people that you know help you get advantage.
So build on that. So due to the history of legal segregation and discrimination in America, many groups have been kept from building wealth. So, I mean, if you really think about it, so if you have racial segregation that's enforced, you have minorities who are being discriminated against, and opportunity hoarding is happening amongst the wealthy, it makes sense that white people have white people in their networks and black people have black people in their networks and so on. But that's exactly where the disadvantage comes in. If black people primarily, or minorities in general, primarily have minorities in their networks, and many of us don't have resources to share, then we are just disadvantaged.
Yeah.
You know, whereas, and that is because of historical events that have kept us from acquiring resources.
Yeah.
So it's not just about, you know, like Zelma and I sitting here are not just a product of our own accomplishments. No. Or our own, you know, assets or whatever. We're the product of our parents and then their parents and then their parents and so on. And so if you go back far enough, you'll understand why we are where we are.
Yeah.
And then you do the same thing for white folks. You know, you go back generations and you see the kinds of resources, the kinds of advantages that they were able to accrue over their lifetime and how things are passed down in a way that that perpetuates disadvantage that may not have necessarily started with our generation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so this kind of goes into our next point, which is the accumulation of advantage and disadvantage. So advantage and disadvantage isn't just something that happens to one, like it doesn't just happen at one point in time.
Mm-hmm.
Wealth is inherited or passed down through generations. And I think an example of this has been one of the things that people always point to is the fact that, you know, for a very, very long time, home ownership was only available to white men. And so they were able, these white men were able to acquire properties that they were able to pass down in their families while other families got excluded. Mm-hmm. You have Native Americans who their land got taken away from them and given, redistributed to white people. You have Mexicans who were living in Texas and California and New Mexico who, when they became part of the United States, their land was taken away and given to American people.
Yeah.
And then you also have, after World War II, people who came back from the war were given houses through, like, it was part of, like, the GI Bill. But guess who wasn't given a house? Black people.
Yeah.
And so you have just constant examples throughout history where white people were given advantages and were given a head start and were given the access to property, which has then caused them to be able to pass it down. And I know a lot of people are like, well, they're all white poor people too. But guess what? White poor people were also given houses. And so just because there is...
They didn't make the most
of it. just because that they are also... their family maintained or stayed poor or didn't... you know, they also got left behind in this gap. Yeah. It doesn't mean that... you still have to take into account that they were able to have access to certain things that other groups have been excluded from for hundreds of years.
So they had the resources. Yes. They just didn't use them the way that other wealthy people did.
Yes.
And that could have been for a number of circumstances, but it was not systematic disadvantage or racism that kept them from making use of those resources. It was their own decision making.
Yeah.
You know, so when you look at white people today and like kind of the, you know, what one of the in the know things that Zelma was talking about with black people in housing, right? So when you look at what's happening today, you also have to take account for what happened historically because they're linked. So you hear people all the time say, say to black people like, oh, stop talking about slavery. You don't know any slaves. And it has nothing to do with that. It has to do with the period of time between when black people arrived in this country and were enslaved to now and what kinds of resources were afforded to them. Or just like how Zelma was saying, Native American land was literally taken from them. So if you have people, if you know someone that owns a house and is living in the house, the land was not theirs.
Yeah.
So literally, their advantage is the product of someone else's disadvantage.
Yes.
That is a reality. So we're not sitting here saying that like, oh, you know, you should give up your house and da-da-da. No. But when you hear about opportunities potentially being given today to Native Americans to make their lives better, don't vote against it.
Yeah.
That's what we're saying. Don't be a part of the problem. Help to fix the problem because your advantage is literally the product of their disadvantage.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. And so inequalities, so historically some groups have been and continue to be legally blocked from acquiring assets like I talked about, but this isn't just about owning homes, but also access to home loans, which put the descendants at a considerable disadvantage. So like I spoke about earlier in our In the Know, even black homeowner or potential homeowners who had good credit, even higher credit than white applicants, were given loans with higher interest rates. So they're basically paying more for their homes than other white people. And so even in acquiring wealth, because home ownership is contributing to your wealth, they're getting disadvantaged.
And why is that again?
And it's because, because they're black.
Mm-hmm.
Because of their racial.
Because the banks don't trust
minority.
Them. Because the banks think, like, oh, they're going to, what do they think they're going to do? They're going to default on their loan. They're just going to take the house and run. We're going to charge them more for the house, which is going to make it more difficult for them to pay. That makes no sense.
Yeah, no, it doesn't. So inequalities and social division are maintained by keeping advantages to a select group of people. And then disadvantage adds up throughout the life course. And so how this relates to the admission scandal is that a lot of these schools are like Ivy League schools.
Yeah.
There were Stanford, Harvard, USC. Yale. And then also schools that are very competitive to get into, like USC and UCLA.
UCLA was not on that.
Oh, okay. My bad. USC. But I also saw that UT Austin. The men's tennis coach got fired for taking like over $100,000 to have people on his team to be admitted into UT Austin.
Actually, you know what? Let me take that back. So I haven't heard that UCLA was a part of this, but I would not be surprised if, especially the athletics situation, were, you know, a part of this.
Yeah.
Or maybe they hadn't been caught, but I'm sure they were doing something.
Yeah, We'll see this on a wide scale. I mean, California schools are so, like, competitive because so many people want to go to those schools. Mm-hmm. And so I can imagine that there's probably a lot of bribing going on or hoarding of resources that wealthy people, there's a lot of wealthy people that live in California, are able to take advantage of to get their children into the schools that they want them to go to. And so when you have the wealthy people kind of going, so you, Ivy League schools, there's this like idea that if you go to an Ivy League school, your life is set. Like, if you look at our presidents, if you look at CEOs, if you look at wealthy people, if you look at celebrities, a lot of those people go to top-notch schools. And so there's a lot of rich people that go. I think I saw a number that it was like, they accept more people out of the top 1%. Than the bottom 60% combined. So they're accepting more wealthy people into these elite schools. And so if you have the people who end up becoming billionaires, who end up becoming people in politics, who make these decisions, who end up becoming presidents, if the rich people are just making it so that only rich people are getting access to these schools that funnel you into these great opportunities, then it keeps excluding the type of people that the poorer people or even middle class people that from these opportunities. And so this is a way in which social division is maintained and advantage is kept within this group. And so if you only keep certain families going to Ivy Leagues, if only rich people keep going to Ivy Leagues, then you're only going to have rich people becoming billionaires and only rich people becoming politicians and only rich people becoming presidents. And in that way, they're keeping the resources to themselves. Yeah. And then on the other side of this, disadvantage adds up throughout the life course. So as white, you know, as where we have wealthy people building up their advantage by saying, well, I'm wealthy, so I can pay a consultant to help you with your application, and I can donate a building, or I can pay $500,000 to get mm-hmm. you into the school. And then once you get into the school, you'll meet other rich people, and then you'll get a job with other rich people. And then you're just going to, it just adds and adds and adds. The same thing happens with the disadvantage. So if you're disadvantaged, if you're poor and you don't know, like me, you don't know anyone who went to college, then you're stuck being like, so the reason I only applied to one college because I didn't, one, couldn't afford all the application fees. Two, couldn't afford to leave the city that I was from. Three, had to work to help my family. And four, just like, honestly, the school I went to had such an easy application that I still needed help with it. Yeah. And so because of this, you know, I am now at a better school than I went to for my undergrad. But I can see the other people that are in this program with me that went to quote unquote better schools. Mm-hmm. And I see how much resources and how much effort and how much extracurricular activities. And I look at their resumes and their CVs and I'm like, oh, wow, like you really trained your whole life to come to a school like this. Whereas for me, I'm like, by chance, I ended up here. I did not ever think that I would actually end up at a school like this. Yeah, everything had to work.
Had to fall into place.
Yeah, like, whereas other people are like, no, I knew I was going to get into this because I applied to this school, so I would end up at a good school anyway. Where for me, I was like, I'm still surprised that I'm here.
Yeah.
And that
impacts you. That impacts how you work while you're here, how well you're able to do. For other students, things may just come to them, or they may even have people in their network that will help them while they're here. Yeah. Whereas, you know, for other students that come from more disadvantaged backgrounds, it's like, it's just you. Yeah. But again, you know, one thing that I want to emphasize, because in my opinion, right, like one day, hopefully my children or at some point my descendants will have it a lot better than I did, right? Hopefully they'll work hard, but they won't have to work as hard. So my critique of these folks is like, yes, I mean, obviously don't cheat and all that stuff, right? But when it comes to, like, you can't help the fact that you're wealthy, especially kids that are born into wealth. Like, you can't help that fact. So I'm not saying don't use your wealth to your advantage. But when it comes to folks who are at a disadvantage, Don't complain, basically. When it comes to folks that are disadvantaged and that are trying to do better for themselves or trying to create opportunities, or you have politicians that are trying to create opportunities for these folks, don't block it. And that is what I see a lot of wealthy white folks doing, which is the most irritating part, is that it's like you're not only are you, like, for instance, over the years, there have been quite a few black high school students that you've seen their posts go viral because it's like, oh, I applied to 100 schools and I got into all of them. Yeah. And you hear all these white people complaining and even newscasters. Oh, why would you apply to 100 schools when you can only go to one? You're taking spots away from other students and blah, 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 blah. No, that is because when you're a poor student, you're going to be on financial aid. There is a chance that you may not get into a school, not because you're not qualified, but because they can't afford you. Yeah. You know, they have a certain number of slots for financial aid students. And so if you're not coming in with external scholarships, then no, you cannot get into this school because they can't afford to pay for you.
Yeah.
And so you have these people and these kids are taking chances. They're not buying their way into school. They don't know whether they'll get in or not. It's not guaranteed. So you know what? I'm going to apply to as many schools as I can and hope for the best. But yet you have these people kind of producing this narrative that, oh, these Black students, they're taking positions away from other students by applying to a bunch of schools, when that's just not the case. You can't take a position away when you are not in the school.
Yeah.
You have not accepted an admission. You're not taking a slot away.
Yeah.
But it's when you have minority students that are doing their damnedest to try to do better for themselves, you have these wealthy people blocking them, continuing to put up blockades as if they are not using their wealth and their privilege to their advantage.
Yeah.
You know, you have these dreamers that just want to go to school.
Yeah.
That's what they do. That's all they want to do.
And they can't get financial aid, yeah. So they're paying for their way to school.
And you know what the white people do? Complain.
They're taking a spot of someone
Complain.
Else.
Yeah. And vote against it.
Yeah.
But it's like, no, you're doing everything in your power to get your kids there.
Yeah.
When your kids have everything already, like they got all the tutors, they got all the coaches,
yeah.
They can get all the training, they take all the classes, they have all the extracurricular activities, all of this shit that you're pouring into your kid, and they still don't want to go to college. You still got Lori Loughlin's daughter on YouTube after she cheated her way into school.
Yeah.
And she's saying, you guys know I don't really want to go to school. I just want to party.
I'm going to Fiji.
I don't really know how much time I'm going to be able to devote to school.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know how much class I'm going to be able to attend.
Yeah. Yeah.
And all these other kids want to do is be there. That's all they want.
Yeah.
And it's not even because, I want to go to college because I want to make more money and blah, blah, blah. No, it's because they think that an education
would get them. She said she wanted to go to the, I want to go to a party.
Yeah, she just wants to party and go to games.
Yeah.
And you got all these little poor kids that are just, that are killing themselves to get there.
Yeah.
Oh my God. This is like so disgusting.
No,
I'm like disgusted.
Is. No, yeah. So as we discussed last season, in one of our episodes, higher education is not the great equalizer. And I think that a lot of times in this country, we are fed the lie that if you just get an education, anyone can get an education. Education is for everyone. All you have to do is, if you get an education, you can be as successful as anyone. And an education is going to be your ticket out. And I think that these are some of the reasons that that's not true. And so, first of all, it's getting harder and harder to get admission into quote-unquote elite schools. And so, as you can see, people with resources and wealth are finding ways so that they can circumvent a lot of these obstacles and still get their kids into schools. Right now, getting good grades, good SAT scores, and doing extracurricular activities by themselves is not good enough anymore. It used to be that if you got a really good SAT score, you had a really good chance of going into a university. In the state that I went to, I'm from Texas, and so there was this rule where the top 10% was able to go to any state school. Mm-hmm. Like, you automatically got accepted. Mm-hmm. And I was in the top 10%. And I always joke that my partner wasn't in the top 10%, and he had a lot of resources, and I didn't. And I couldn't afford to go to the top mm-hmm. state school in my state, and he could. And mm-hmm. so he always, one of the examples he uses is he's like, I can't believe that you basically, like, you know, a lot of people were waitlisted, and he's mm-hmm. like, you know, I didn't know if I was going to get into this school. It was so competitive, and you automatically got in and you chose not to go. And in my head, I'm just kind of like, it's not that I chose not to go. That wasn't even an option.
Yeah.
And so he could not fathom that I would choose not to go to the best school in Texas, to him, the best state school in Texas.
What is it?
UT Austin. And for me, it's like, well, I couldn't afford it. And looking back, I'm like, how different would my life have been? Like, I was able to, like, beat out all these, because I went to a school in River Oaks, the city. It's one of the wealthiest neighborhoods in the country.
Wow.
And so I was competing with people who, like, are super rich.
Yeah.
And I was able to beat them in the ranking and to be able to take a, quote unquote, take a spot. But because I was poor, I wasn't able to go to that school. And so it's just like, it just, like, disadvantage doesn't, and that one decision of going to that, like, could have changed the trajectory of my life. Mm-hmm. I took out a lot of loans to go to school, and I didn't know that you actually got financial aid for being in the top 10%. And I just didn't know that because no one ever told me. And
you couldn't take out loans to go to UT?
I didn't know. I didn't know. I went to a religious school,
mm-hmm.
and in the religious school, it was just kind of like they gave me different types of scholarships. So you get a scholarship if you go to a church or something. Mm-hmm.
And I didn't know how to apply for a loan to be able to go to a school in a different city. Because I'd have to take out a loan to, like, live somewhere. I'd have to take out a loan to the tuition. And I'd have to take out a loan for my expenses. Yeah. And that just didn't seem like a possibility. So I didn't even consider it.
That's so strange that, like, you went to that high school that has all those resources and there was nobody to tell you.
No one reached out to me. No. That's because there wasn't, like, these white kids just knew. Like, they just knew what to do. I didn't even know that you were supposed to apply for housing before you applied for the school. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's so competitive that you want to be guaranteed a place to live. So you have to put a deposit down. And so if you don't get in, you just lose your deposit. But if you get in, then you have housing. And I couldn't have afforded it. My family couldn't afford to put down a deposit
and
for
then
a place
to lose
not
it. Yeah.
But I didn't know that. And the only way they knew that is because it's just like, it's a thing that they passed, information that they passed down. And so I just, like, looking back, I'm like, my good grades, my being in 10%, my being the editor of our school newspaper of 3,000 people, I was the editor of the newspaper. Mm-hmm. None of that was good enough for me to be able to go to a top tier school. I ended up going to a school that I could afford because I just didn't have the resources or the knowledge. And then another thing I wanted to point out that I learned in graduate school is that extracurricular activities are biased. So I remember coming across a lot of people who would say that, and I think it's not just in graduate school, is in being in a relationship with someone from a different class bracket. And so with my partner, his sister went to Africa for a summer and she got into a really good law school. Mm-hmm. So she got into a good undergrad and then she got into a good law school. And now she is in a really good law firm. And she got all these things because I was like, you know, she's really smart. But I was like, how does she do all this stuff? And he was just telling me like, oh, yeah, she spent a summer in Africa and she like volunteered there and was helping kids. And she put that on her application. And I was thinking like, poor people, one, don't have time to spend a summer in Africa, and two, don't have the resources to do anything abroad. Yeah. So even if I would have gotten, I think even if someone would have paid for me to go and said, okay, all expenses paid, you get to volunteer at this orphanage. Summers, I had to work with my mom to help, like to help pay for my things so that she wouldn't have to pay them for me. Mm-hmm. And so I'm thinking like, even if someone paid for me to go, I wouldn't have been able to. I would have had to stay with my mom. Mm-hmm. And so when I got to graduate school, I had no extracurricular activities because my extracurricular activities was like translating for my undocumented family or helping, you know, someone with domestic violence.
She went to Africa in college?
Yeah.
Oh, I thought this was like some kind of high school, like missionary trip.
No.
Oh,
it's
crazy.
Like things to build up her application so that she could get into a good law school.
Wow.
And I mean, it worked. She got into a good law school. And it's just, and thinking about that, I was like, extracurricular activities, things that you do extra, workshops that you go to, things that you do too in the summer all require money and all require the free time.
Yeah.
And so that excludes a lot of disadvantaged people.
Yeah.
So when you have these harder criteria to get into schools, then you're already funneling out people to stand out. Only people who can afford to stand out will be able to stand out.
And I mean, so like, let's think about internships, right? And so a lot of internships when you're in college are unpaid.
A lot.
And that disadvantages a lot of students. You know, like if we think about for law school, right? Like a lot of students are doing that work for free. You have to be able to afford to work for free for a summer. A lot of poor kids can't.
Yeah.
You know, like they're spending all of their summers working, like for actual money. And so when it comes, like that, and that was even a conversation that I had now with my advisor because I was, you know, we were talking about how I can secure a non-academic job after school. And like one of the ways was to get an internship now. But I cannot do an unpaid internship that takes away from time that I'm devoting to my dissertation. And I also need the money. No, I cannot spend a 6 year doing an unpaid internship.
How?
But that affects a lot. And like these companies and these corporations are set up in that way because they're based on a wealthy white culture.
Yeah.
They don't understand. It probably never even occurred to them that there are probably not able to, they probably need minority students because it looks good, right, yeah, to have minority students doing these internships, and they're probably wondering why they aren't getting enough minority student applicants, and it's because they cannot afford to sacrifice that time,
yeah,
doing unpaid work. Yeah. They need the money because their parents are not, their parents don't have the extra money to give to them, to support, yeah, them, to pay their rent, to pay their car note, their insurance, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, which leads to the final point about how higher education is not the great equalizer, and it's the whole legacy admissions. So legacy admission is basically if your parents or someone in your family went to this school, then you have a high probability that you're going to go to this school. And
I think they have a certain number of slots for these
kids. For legacies, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And so, like, the reason that legacy admission reinforces inequality is because of what we were just talking about. So these are the ramifications of the history of legal discrimination and segregation. So if white people created the institutions with the stipulation that no one else could attend, right? So because there was a point where there were only white men at universities, all the Ivies all the Ivies, all white men. Majority of these universities, even though they were built on Native American land and many of them by slaves, they were only able to be attended by white men. Yes. And then it opened up to white women and then slowly people of color.
Yes.
Right? And so with that being the case, who are these legacies? Who is it that gets to benefit from this status?
Yeah.
It's white people. Yeah. And so a lot of times there are these little things in place that we actually, you know what, Zelma and I will create a meme of all the different ways that some of these things that we don't even consider help to reproduce this inequality. Things that we completely take for granted, like unpaid internships and like legacy status. It isn't the students of color. It isn't the poor students that get to take advantage of these opportunities.
Yeah. I mean, my parents didn't even go to college here. So
yeah, it's like you would be a legacy of what?
Yeah, I'd be a legacy of poverty.
But. Yeah. And it's like so long as oh my God, Zelma. That just like processed my mind. No, you will not. You will not. But because these opportunities exist. So the way that legacy works a lot of times is not that like, well, for some universities and some organizations, you're automatically granted admission, mm-hmm. right? Based on that. But then for others, it's that you do have to have the grades and things like that, but they're a little bit more lenient on you.
Yeah.
Like there is space to say like, oh, well, my parents, my grandparents went to this school or whatever. So I have the grades. So I'm going to get it. So they have a certain number of positions, legacy slots usually set aside for these students. So usually the legacy students are competing against one another.
Yeah.
They're not competing against, like, all the other students. Mm-hmm. So all of these reasons, right, we're gonna boil it down and synthesize why the admission scam matters. But everything that we talked about is why it matters.
Yeah.
Everything that we talked about is the reason why this is bigger than just a scandal, that impacts potentially these students if they get kicked out of school, which I don't really know I'm not really confident that would happen.
I don't think so.
But I mean, I don't know if it would matter anyway, because do we even know whether or not they want to be there in the first place? Lori Loughlin's daughter does not.
They're probably going to be set whether they go to college.
Yeah, they're definitely set. Like, her dad is like, who is it? Mosimo or whatever. Like,
which is fucked up because I used to wear this stuff from Target all the time.
Yeah. Yeah, I probably still have some of that stuff in my closet. But it's like, you know, the fact that, like, she doesn't want to be there, you know? And she was saying, like, in her video, we posted it on our page if you want to see a clip of it. But, you know, she was going to Fiji in the first week of school and here and there and there. Yeah. And she was going to talk to her professors and get it all handled to where, like, you know, her attendance isn't mandatory. And it's like, there's so many other students that don't get to do that. Yeah. Like, professors give you, there are times where kids that are poor, right, that are supporting their family or all of these different things have to call out a score, or non-traditional students that have children have to call out a class, and they get like they get talked down to by the professors, and yet you got little girls going to Fiji for fun because she's an Instagram influencer, YouTube influencer, and professors are not going to say shit to her because she's a celebrity.
So ultimately, why the admission scam matters. First, it's the American, like we've talked about, the American dream of being successful based on your hard work is a lie. The system is rigged. The system is set up to benefit those with privilege and advantage, who tend to be mostly white wealthy families. The rich keep the resources to them. They do this by keeping the resources to themselves. This is what we call opportunity hoarding. Education shouldn't be for a select few, but it is. And so I think the fact that this lie is used to not only justify, I think this lie is used to kind of make it seem like rich people make it on their own, or like their kids are making it on their own. Mm-hmm. And I think what's funny, it's like these videos have been surfacing of these celebrities talking about how they, you know, aren't going to be the type of parents who like baby their kids, or their kids are going to make it on their own, or their kids are going to know hard work. And it's like, these are the lies that they tell us so that we don't get mad. Because if we found out that that's not true, then we would get mad. And, you know, although I think poor people and people of color are judged way on a different, there's a double standard. We're judged on a different scale yeah. than these white privileged people. And the biggest example of this is affirmative action. Mm-hmm. So affirmative action is always criticized by saying that not only are people of color or minorities taking spots that are deserving of white people, but that they may not deserve it and that it's unfair. But the ways in which wealthy people maintain advantage and privilege, like the ones we just spoke about with these celebrities paying someone to take the test for them, paying a psychologist to lie about their disability status, paying a coach to lie and say that they're an athlete, are ignored. And so, and in addition to the legacy admission process is overlooked. Yeah. And so poor people yeah. are criticized, but rich people aren't.
Yeah. And I mean, the fact that What affirmative action was meant to do in the first place is often ignored in these conversations. Mm-hmm. Affirmative action was there to right a wrong, not to just give people of color and women access to institutions just because they're people of color and women. No, it was because they had been systematically excluded and legally excluded, and illegally excluded and discriminated and kept out of these organizations, irrespective of merit. So it was that white men created these institutions and said, you know what? These institutions are just for us. Even though all of our cultural values are going to be based on you having been a part of these institutions. So we're going to define what it means to be successful in America based on having been a part of these institutions, and we're going to keep everybody else out. That is ridiculous. And so after a century of doing this, affirmative action came along and was meant to right a wrong and to make space, to force space in these institutions for people of color and women.
Yeah.
It was not to give handouts for people that didn't deserve it. No, these people were deserving, but because of discrimination, they had been kept out. So yes, I mean, to act like we are here and to treat us like we're here, and we don't deserve it, is bullshit. So people of color and people from low income families, pat yourselves on the back for making it into these schools.
Yeah.
And for graduating.
Yeah.
Without paying or cheating your way in.
Yeah.
They've put every blockade and hurdle in front of you, and you've excelled by leaps and bounds in spite of it.
Yeah.
So we belong, we earned it, and we should be proud.
Yes. And stop feeling like you don't belong.
Yeah.
Or, I mean, this should help us all. Who are specifically in elite universities or in universities that are very competitive to get into, or anyone in a fucking university, no matter what, that there are people, like, you were able to get there without having to pay your way in and take advantage. And I think, like, that in itself speaks a lot about, like, just how proud we should be that we got to where we are. And I think that a lot of times we're hard on ourselves because society is hard on us. Like, well, this should just be a given that you should just get into a college, where because of this admission scandals now, I'm like, okay, I'm kind of proud of myself that I'm able to do this without my parents. I'm angry, but I'm also like proud that I was able to get to where I am. And I don't, you know, it's I didn't have to cheat my way in to do it.
Yeah. And it's like, imagine what your kids are going to do. Imagine what you would have been able to do had it not been for all those disadvantages.
Yeah.
What? You'd be fucking president.
Yeah, well, that is our episode. We hope you enjoy it. As always, if you have any feedback or comments, send us an email at woke.ishpodcast@gmail.com. Also, feel free to follow us on Instagram at wokeishpodcast. Send us a message. Feel free to comment on the videos that we post. If you have any suggestions for topics, if you want to add on to the conversation, or if you want to just share something that you disagreed with or that you really agreed with, feel free to contact us. We apologize for the miss. We kind of skipped a little bit.
Yeah, a delay.
Yeah, but we had our spring break and we spring breaked it up.
Yeah.
But yeah, we are definitely back and we will be back to our regular schedule unless something else comes up. Also, again, I wanted to apologize for the audio quality in our last episode. We tried something new with how we recorded it. And so we are, you know, just going to try to learn from our mistakes and try to figure out the best way to do things. But we appreciate all the listeners that we have. Yeah. And shout out to all our international listeners.
Yeah. We just found out that, like, we were looking at our metrics and we just found out that we have some people listening from beyond the U.S. And so that is, I mean, we love all of our American listeners, but it's so dope that we have somehow reached markets beyond the United States.
Yeah.
So thank you all so much for your patience. Thank you so much for listening. We hope you enjoy the episode. Let us know what you think.